Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And Vice President Biden said today that President Obama is determined to curb gun violence in the United States, and the president will act. But is there anything that, the president can do via executive order?
Well, that is an interesting question because, of course, Biden implied that there were things that could be done. There certainly are some things that fall within the executive branch's purview. The question is, how much can they do unless they can get some kind of congressional authorization to empower ATF to do things that, everyone says they ought to be able to do? Like, currently, ATF is forbidden to do more than one surprise inspection a year. You know, you can imagine what would happen to the restaurants in Los Angeles if suddenly they knew that they only had to fear being inspected once. What would happen, you know, once that inspection had occurred? No one would really imagine that the quality of food being served in L.A. would be any safer. So that kind of thing, some of the regulations require congressional involvement. But there apparently are all kinds of absurdities in the way that ATF is hampered in terms of their ability to use computers to automate background checks. So there may well be some things that, even without a congressional consensus, the executive branch might be able to improve the way they enforce gun laws.
Well, of course, the reason ATF is hobbled, and I spoke recently with a former ATF agent, is because of the Congress and because of the influence of the NRA over the Congress. They have the Tie-Hard Amendment, for example,
sure,
totally ties their hands for all law enforcement, sharing data on crime guns. Now, the NRA...
Of course, isn't it great that the great champions of the Second Amendment don't seem to have as much respect for the First Amendment?
Well,
you know, they're trying to deport Pierce Morgan. They're preventing academic research on gun violence, and they have the Tie-Hard Amendment. It sort of speaks of a level of hypocrisy that's really unrivaled in American politics.
Well, but the hypocrisy, I think the central hypocrisy of the NRA is that they say that they're protecting the rights of law-abiding citizens, when in fact the Tie-Hard Amendment is protecting the rights of criminals, because crime guns, guns used in crime, are already prima facie evidence of criminality. And the idea that data on these guns and who sold them, when, where, and how, is not the law enforcement is not able to share that data because of this congressional amendment put through by the NRA.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And I think one of the things that we're seeing happening now, for really the first time that I can recall, is there we've reached a sort of tipping point in American politics after the horror of what happened at Newtown. I think we've reached a point almost like we reached in the civil rights movement when those three civil rights workers were murdered, and suddenly the civil rights movement was not just a movement about African Americans. The civil rights movement was something that all Americans could feel connected to. And we're now at a moment, I think, where people who did not see the gun issue as their issue have finally said, you know, this is something that affects all of us. We have an obligation to protect our children, our communities. And I'm hearing from people all over the country that we're actually now in a different place. Whether that's enough to break the dysfunctionality and some of the perverse incentives in our political system remains to be seen. But for the first time, we're seeing the beginnings of a popular movement to try and restore some sanity to our public debate over guns. And we haven't really seen a grassroots movement like that before.
Again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. You mentioned Pierce Morgan of CNN and how there's a move afoot by supporters of the NRA and the so-called gun rights community to have him deported. Of course, his exchange on his program with Alex Jones has gone viral, and a lot of people have commented on it, and particularly on what a bizarre character Alex Jones is. And of course, he's a protege of the the cult leader that went up in flames at Waco. He's also, by the way, the producer and financier of a film that the Pacifica Network has distributed called Loose Change, about the 9/11 conspiracy. And, you know, there are a lot of people clearly on the left in the Pacifica community who actually think that they're on the left when they support a rabid right-wing, paranoid, anti-government, poisonous, I better stop now. I mean, what's going on in our politics?
I mean, I've sometimes been surprised at the strange bedfellows gun rights makes. I mean, you do sometimes see in the gun rights community groups that would hardly align together, align behind gun rights. So, you know, you get former Black Panthers and KKK members, each affirming a fairly aggressive interpretation of gun rights. It's a peculiarly bizarre American configuration of politics. But yes, the thing that I found most striking, I mean, obviously the insanity of it was what was probably most striking, but that there are, it's not just Alex Jones. You can actually go onto the National Review website, and you can see people arguing that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to give us the right to overthrow our government, which is hard to reconcile with the fact that the Constitution only defines one crime, which is treason, which is defined as taking up arms against the government. So according to this bizarre theory of the Second Amendment seems to have repealed the treason clause of the Constitution, except nobody seems to have noticed that until the gun rights community made this rather bizarre claim.
Just to elaborate on that a little bit, on the treason clause.
Well, the treason is defined in the Constitution as a crime that involves taking up arms against the government. And if you look at some of the gun rights rhetoric, where they talk about Second Amendment solutions to political problems, they talk about needing guns, things like adapted military weapons like AR-15s. They need them because they need to be able to take on the government. That's really hard to reconcile with the fact that treason is a crime that's defined by the Constitution. Also hard to reconcile with the fact that at the time of the American Revolution, most of the states imposed loyalty oaths, which required you to swear an loyalty oath to the new state governments or be disarmed. So obviously the founders were not against disarming people who were making claims that they were going to take up arms against the government. And then there's the fact that the Constitution itself is at least in part a response to Shays' Rebellion, where farmers decided unilaterally that they could create their own militias and take up arms against the government. The Founding Fathers were not the people who supported Daniel Shays. They were the people who sent in troops to put down the rebellion. So we get this funny thing in the debate over the Second Amendment and gun rights where historical reality is almost inverted. And the version that you find in sort of popular gun rights ideology is almost the mirror image of the historical reality.
Well, indeed, it is turning history on its head to believe, as the so-called gun rights community does, that the Second Amendment is about their right to protect themselves from their own government, when in fact, if anybody studies American history, particularly Tom Paine and others who talked about summer soldiers and sunshine patriots, what was happening was that George Washington and company were giving out guns to their recruits, and a lot of them were the summer soldiers and sunshine patriots who just wandered off with the guns. That's why they wanted a well-regulated militia. The government didn't want to be in the business of proliferating firearms to people who showed up sensibly to fight the British, but then wandered off when it suited them.
Well, the thing that's really bizarre from my point of view is to hear someone like Senator Ted Cruz say that the idea of registration is a violation of the Second Amendment. He obviously hasn't encountered George Washington, who proposed in 1783 that we create a national militia muster roll and put everyone's name on it who is eligible to bear arms and inspect their weapons twice a year. Obviously, Senator Cruz hasn't studied enough American history to know that his interpretation of the Second Amendment, if it had been operationalized in 1776, we would have lost the American Revolution, because we wouldn't have been able to muster a well-regulated militia unless we knew who was in it, what kind of weapons they had, the quality of the weapons, whether they had been properly trained with them. So the whole idea that the Second Amendment is some barrier to all kinds of common-sense regulations, including registration, if we decide that that's a good policy, and there's a lot of reasons to think it is a good policy, the idea that could somehow be unconstitutional just reveals a level of ignorance of American history and basic constitutional law. That's shocking for someone like Cruz to be spouting on Fox News or on the NewsHour.
Well, quite recently, though, and obviously your forthcoming book, Saul Cornell, The Second Amendment Goes to Court, will deal with this. The Supreme Court, talk about history being turned on its head by the gun rights people. The Supreme Court pretty much turned the Second Amendment on its head, didn't they? The predicate, which is the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be infringed. The predicate is the state shall have well-regulated militias. That was always essentially guiding gun laws in this country. And then the Supreme Court turned around and took the second part of it and put it essentially at the front, didn't they?
Well, it is ironic because, of course, when the Second Amendment was being written, they very consciously arranged the order so that the militia clause came first as a preamble. And I like to say that Scalia's interpretation of the Second Amendment is a bit like the Cheshire Cat. You know, the preamble disappears when it's inconvenient and then only appears once you've already made up your mind about what the amendment means. And, of course, he's been criticized by not just liberals. In fact, the criticism of his opinion has been far more harsh from conservatives, who said that basically he had discredited the theory of originalism, that it was an incoherent and manipulative use of historical and legal evidence. But of course, even accepting that it wasn't a very well crafted decision, the fact remains that there have been about 600 cases since Heller, and the vast majority of them, the laws have been upheld. There have been very few laws that have actually been struck down after Heller. So the idea that even having engaged in a kind of a bold revisionist exercise where they essentially, you know, turned the Constitution into an etch-a-sketch and sort of erased the first bit of the Second Amendment. Even under that version of the Second Amendment, virtually any of the gun violence prevention measures, the common sense gun regulations that people are talking about, all of them would be constitutional. The only things that really, it's almost hard to imagine anything that could ever be passed by a legislative body that could be unconstitutional, because clearly the wholesale banning of handguns that Washington and Chicago did is off the table, but reasonable regulations, licensing, registration, requirements for training, limits on high capacity ammunition clips, a whole range, you know, safe storage requirements, at least safe storage requirements for when there are children in the house or mentally unstable adults, as was the case in Newtown. It's hard to imagine that any court could strike those kinds of common sense gun regulations down.
So, Saul Cornell, Vice President Biden on Wednesday met with some of the people who have advocated gun control. And, of course, we did have an assault weapons ban for 10 years. They put a sunset clause in it, and George W. Bush refused to renew it. And Senator Feinstein, who was responsible for the original assault weapons ban, is going to reintroduce it. But the vice president met with the Brady campaign and other groups opposed to the proliferation of guns and particularly military-style weapons, along with the victims of the massacres at Virginia Tech and at survivors also of Aurora, Colorado, and the attorney general. And then Thursday, he meets with the NRA, and apparently the biggest seller of guns in the country, Walmart, initially didn't want to attend the meeting, but then they've changed their mind. So they're apparently going to show up on Thursday to meet with the vice president. We talked about what the president might be able to do in terms of an executive order, in terms of taking the handcuffs off the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosive Agency, which is used to be with the Treasury, is now with the Justice Department. It hasn't had a leader for the last 6 years. So what about public opinion? The thing that I find extraordinary about this is that clearly there's no lobby, a counter-lobby against the NRA. But if you look at the numbers of the NRA, they only have about 4 million members. That really makes them the 1% in terms of America's population. So is their bark worse than their bite? Is there enough people out there in the 99% to suddenly stand up? I know after these massacres, people are much more motivated and then the energy seems to dissipate. But it would seem to me that they're happening so frequently, these massacres, that this is something I think that you simply, as a culture, as a people, as a country, we can't sweep under the rug anymore?
Well, I think that the money that the NRA has certainly has helped it, and it's important to recognize that every time you buy a firearms, you know, for instance, Sturm Ruger here in Connecticut donates a dollar to the NRA. So the NRA is not just a representative of gun owners, it's also a representative of the gun industry. And, of course, we haven't had a peace industry to counter it in quite the same way. But I think the key is that after Newtown, there seems to be for the first time an upwelling, a grassroots movement of people who are really frustrated and who feel like we're not doing enough and who feel like there are enough things that are so obvious that need to be done that most gun owners support, that even in some cases most NRA members support, like expanding background checks so that everyone who gets a firearm is legally entitled to one, no matter where they buy it from, unless it's some, you know, back alley channel, and there you get into sort of policing issues as opposed to regulations of sales. But there's no question that there now is a belief that we have to make this an issue that we're all willing to show up to a legislative hearing in our state capitol. One of the reasons the NRA has been so successful is they've been able to turn out the vote. They have a very loyal, zealous membership. There are other even more zealous gun groups that make the NRA look somewhat moderate, which is, of course, hard to believe, but true. And until we have soccer moms and, you know, grandparents and soccer coaches all showing up to counter those people who will be at the legislative hearings, we won't really see change. But I think for the first time, I'm hearing a lot of people say, if I have to take a day off from work to make my school safer, I'm going to do it. So I think we're starting to see spontaneous popular interest in this issue. And if that popular movement can be channeled, we may well see some major legislative changes.
Perhaps we should reverse the NRA's call to put armed militia in schools and put teachers in gun stores.
Well, that's kind of an interesting suggestion. I mean, one of the problems I think we have in this debate is also that the NRA and the gun rights community have been very effective at staying on point and at articulating a message that fits on a bumper sticker. One of the problems is the people who favor sensible gun regulation, you know, the very term sensible gun regulation obviously does not work as effectively as a soundbite as, when guns are outlawed, only outlawers will have guns. So I think there's a real challenge to articulate a message that people can rally around and to set an agenda that people can commit themselves to. And I think there's also no question that, I was listening to some mothers talk today about the experience of being in a school during a lockdown. I think as more and more people actually know someone who goes through that experience and how traumatizing it is for these kids, you know, I live not far from Newtown, and there was someone walking with an umbrella near the train station who was wearing, you know, black jeans and maybe a dark windbreaker or something, and the whole school went into lockdown. The whole school district went into lockdown. In fact, the two towns, because this happened in between the two towns, went into lockdown. And, you know, you've got to understand that you know, herding kids into a closet and having them stay quiet, you know, not knowing whether there's another Newtown shooter on the loose. I mean, this is starting to be something that everyone in America is being touched by. And you know, it's a shame that when these kinds of everyday shootings were occurring in some of our urban areas, there wasn't the same outcry. But you know, now that other people realize, you know, everyone is affected by gun violence, not just people living in urban areas, I think now there is going to be a change. How much of a change still remains to be seen, but there's enormous popularity for some of these measures. There's enormous popularity for background checks. Most gun owners believe in safe storage, so why can't we enact a series of laws that encourage everyone to do what smart gun owners already do. I mean, the place we get to the most conflict is obviously when you begin to start banning certain kinds of weapons. But we're even hearing a much more aggressive discussion around whether or not everyone who wants to have an AR-15 should just be able to walk into the local Walmart, or even worse, walk into the gun show without a background check and just walk out with one. I think that is starting to be troubling to people.
Well, Saul Cornell, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornell, as the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair of American History at Fordham University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how 2012 was the hottest year on record and what is being done here in the United States to address global warming. Happiness is a warm-